coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Welcome to this Worth Doing Badly, and Merry Christmas. Today we will survey the readings for the observance of the Holy Innocents, and they are Jeremiah 31 verses 15 to 17, Psalm 54, Revelation 14 verses 1 to 5, and Matthew 2 verses 13 to 18. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen.
While most people are happy to jump back into everyday life right after Christmas, the Church extends the joy of the Nativity 12 whole days until the Epiphany on January 6. What most people don't realize, however, is that a lot of those 12 days are quite bloody. December 26 commemorates the martyrdom of St. Stephen. December 27th is the feast of St. John the Apostle, who suffered in prison. And December 28 is the feast of the Holy Innocents, the first martyrs to die for Christ. And this year, the Feast of the Holy Innocents falls on a Saturday, and next year it falls on a Sunday. And I think it's worth taking a look at these texts now and consider preaching on them either this year or next year, and sort of force ourselves to lean into the bloodiness of the season. And I think that perhaps the first thing that comes to mind is the question, why does the Church leave us with all this blood during what's supposed to be a joyful time?
Why do you think it's supposed to be a joyful time?
Well, because it's Christmas and you get presents.
Okay, well, while you were talking, it just strikes me the remarkable symmetry and awful beauty of putting Christmas on the festival of the winter solstice, mm-hmm. which was not a joyful time. It was a cry for the return of growth and light and we oftentimes talk about how Christmas is a depressing time for people who are lonely, and there seems to be appearance in the ancient world that it's not just modern loneliness. It was a time that reminds people that we are living in the winter of our discontent. So if Christmas was ever joyful, it was always a joy that was in dialectical tension with a deep brooding sorrow, I think.
Well, and I think you're spot on, right? Because you're right. There's always, in some ways, a pall of mourning cast over the joy. And I like what you say, how it sort of bookends. You actually see, you anticipate the suffering of Christ's passion, even in his nativity. And you get that, you know, you have the deep red of our poinsettias, the wood of the manger, the swaddling cloths, all of those echo Christ's bloody death on Good Friday. And so it reminds us that Jesus came to die. And those first few days right after Christmas, make sure we remember that. We push it away. You know, we do a very good job of trying to ignore that and just basking in the glow coming from the manger. But reality hits really quickly. And that's the thing. I think what these days after, these bloody days after the Nativity do actually remind us that this is a very real thing. And it keeps suffering and death in view. But it also helps us realize that the Incarnation transforms our suffering and sadness and mourning into a resurrection hope.
That said, I think you're right, Ethan, that we have a certain, I'm going to even call it idolatrous disposition towards Christmas. I think we have a tendency to make it into something that it is not. It is not insulation from death. It is a contention with death. It's mm-hmm. death is nearby. It's not far off. And I've noticed recently with funerals that I've done is that, you know, lifelong Christian people are shocked that death is a part of their life. Death is ever near to us, and if the meaning of Christmas is anything, it's that Jesus came to Earth to be near death, and in order to change it and destroy it. So I like how you're approaching Holy Innocence as not this interruption in the Christmas celebration. It's actually extending and redefining what Christmas actually is.
King Herod, right, is our chief enemy here, or maybe he's our biggest friend. It forcing us to reckon with that, because what happens with the martyrdom of the Holy Innocents is tragic and difficult to understand without that resurrection hope, because Herod is just, he's not unique. Right, he's par for the course. He's his paranoia, you know, him maniacally seeking out Jesus, the one who was born King of the Jews, isn't unusual. And for him to murder these innocent infants and toddlers in cold blood, you know, we think it's something that is unheard of, but it's something that rulers would do back then and even through the centuries today. You know, this tyranny, right? Tyranny never goes away. And our circumstances reflect that. We're still, like you said, we're surrounded by death. And even more than that, we're surrounded by senseless death and murder. But the incarnation, you know, forces us to step into that and carries us through it. And out the other end, so that, you know, you get Rachel mourning for her children, she can mourn with hope. With that too, it reminds us that we will share in that. We're going to share in Christ's lot, right? The world had no room for Christ, and it has no room for true Christians either. So the blood of the martyrs is running down through the centuries as a witness today. I say that, but then I doubt that. Do you think there's merit to that? To say that the world has no room for true Christians today?
I don't know exactly what that means, but the thought that crosses my mind is, given the fact that this is the way the world is, that in fact, had the wise men never gone to Herod, this would have never happened. And in the announcement of Jesus' presence actually brought out more evil from Herod than he himself had anticipated. He became evil in a brand new way, reacting to Jesus. So yeah, we talk a lot about Jesus saving us from evil, but the fact is that the reason why we have to be saved is that when he comes into the world, evil knows who the real enemy is. And so what crosses my mind is, if that has always been the case, what kind of what do we expect the church to do or to be? And I know you mentioned the word hope, but hope is an empty word unless it's connected with actual responses to evil, real human responses to evil. So, you know, given the world that of Holy Innocence, what kind of a community would the church have to be, I guess, is crossing my mind. And maybe that's taking you away from where you want to head on this passage.
No, I think that's the direction we have to move. And I think what I would say is the kind of people the church has to be is a people on the move. And in that sense, you know, I mean this gospel is in many ways full of movement, right? You've got the wise men coming in to Jerusalem. You've got Mary and Joseph on the move out into Egypt. So it sort of turns the church into a wandering people, but it's not a useless movement. Well, I would say it's the movement, like you always like to point out, from Kyrie to Gloria, right? From that we have the, you know, hope is an empty word. I agree with you on that. But if you're moving towards it, and your perspective on it is changing, then I think it's perhaps a little more real, you know, and so our movement is from darkness to light and from despair to joy.
What I like about this, in our worship, then, lamentation is going to, people who lament are going to feel at home in worship, which is a very different approach to worship than, you know, always this kind of demand to be ever joyful. And I just think of the history of music, of the Psalms, the lamentation Psalms put to music, and I think it's Palestrina's motets on Jeremiah's lamentation. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, beautiful music, allowing people who are lamenting not to get over the lamentation, but to lean into it. And it just seems like there is a sense of which the giddiness of Christmas is displaced by a more real approach, that what we need is a community in which we are ever reminded of, as you say, of hope. But that hope is expressed musically. It's expressed in prayers and in personal consolation. All of those things which I find that the church needs to recover again, or always is recovering. Maybe we're always missing out on it. So
yeah, I think that's. That's very true, right? That especially when you get into the, I mean, we can spout off about the individualism that really becomes prevalent in the season, right? Even in our generosity of the season, it very much becomes a self-centered thing and not about the life of the community. But I appreciate too what you say about the Psalms, because our psalm for this text is very much a song of lament, but it's also a prayer for vindication, right? And you could very very much put the words of Psalm 54 in the mouths of those innocent infants, right? They're praying that those ruthless men who had risen and sought their lives would be vindicated, that they would be vindicated. And what's comforting is for them, we know that they will be, because Herod the Great is going to die unloved and unmourned. You know, he is going to be completely and utterly forgotten. And it's these infants that we remember in the life of the church year after year after year. But what gets, what's astounding, I think, as with most of the lament psalms, is the added thanksgiving in the midst of the suffering, right? The psalmist offers up a sacrifice and gives thanks to God for his goodness, even though he's experiencing this suffering. And, I mean, it sort of begs the question, how can he, in the midst of suffering, say that God has delivered him from trouble when he's still experiencing it, and that he can look with triumph even now? It's because of that. I keep saying hope, right? But it's because we're continually redefining hope, or not redefining hope, but rediscovering what true hope is.
Well, that's the whole thing, is hope in its initial stages looks cliche and empty. It's only words, right? And eventually, given enough time, those words actually either are validated or falsified, and over and over again. But this goes back to my question, Ethan. If it was your children that this happened, what would you expect from your church? Somehow the church has to be there to fill up the time between when hope is an empty gesture to the point where hope gains traction and actually changes life. The community of the church is there to fill up that time. Doing what? What would you expect from your church, or want your church to be doing?
Well, I know what I wouldn't want the church to be doing, and that would be just creating distractions. In some ways, is our go-to, right? That we're just gonna, you know, all of the funeral home platitudes and distract with that. I mean, part of it has to, the activity of the church is acknowledging truly what has happened and recognizing that it's part of the existence, of our, you know, of our sinful lives. So recognizing that, but at the same time, in many ways, it's worship, right? I mean, what I would expect the church to be doing is to be giving the word, right? The word of peace and comfort in the midst of the tribulation. And not seeking to just make everything feel better, because it's not going to feel better.
It's amazing how oftentimes the church tries to offer counseling or offer some kind of secular way of coping. And that would be the most hopeless thing. You don't want to cope with evil. You want it overcome.
It's happened already, right? It has been overcome and destroyed. And so the role of the church in many ways is to translate that joy, the true joy, to that moment, the joy and the hope that go hand in hand in the resurrection life, to make it real, what we think is just a far off expectation.
This really does join Christmas with the crucifixion, and to see that the church here is not divided up into seasons. It's a continuous, as you said, movement, and that movement is itself the expression of hope.
And then we get echoes of that anticipation for hope in the passage from Jeremiah, speaking of the Babylonian captivity, and it's that movement again in the midst of the sorrow. Despair is going to be reigning, right? The thought is that the Israel is going to be completely and utterly destroyed and absorbed into the people of Babylon, and Rachel's children would be no more. But then comes the promise from the mouth of Jeremiah: they shall come back. Your children shall come back to their own country. So again, the movement, we are not meant to stay in one place. And it's, you know, we're not in the Gospel of John, but, you know, we hear John 1, on Christmas Day, and you get that language of abiding, of staying in place, but the place where you dwell is in the Word. And I don't want to say paradoxically, but there's this tension between always being on the move back to our own country, while maintaining a stability in the Word, dwelling, abiding in that hope for the future. So I think Jeremiah gets at that tension a little bit, and I don't know if that's worth bringing in this particular context, but maybe it is, because of the stability comes from the Word, and that's the Word that the church is to present, to proclaim in the midst of instability.
You've said a couple times here that there is something about the words of these passages that has depth and grittiness to it. It's not dodging anything. It's recognizing that Rachel will not be comforted, and yet in the midst of that, the Lord says, keep your voice from weeping, right? Even though the bitterness is real, it is not ultimately real or finally real. And so eventually the tears are going to have to give way to worship. And then I just love the point that there is reward in your work. Even something as futile and vain as suffering, there will be reward. And that is either so terribly numb to the suffering, or it is, you know, just a bit of light that's creeping into the darkness that changes the sorrow into lamentation, and the lamentation into praise. So
we don't mourn without hope, right? We don't mourn uselessly, and that's a beautiful promise, right? That even sorrow and mourning and suffering is a good work that the Lord looks favorably upon. I mean, you could see that coming in all of the three main readings, right? That out of Egypt I called my son, so Christ will return to Israel to have his ministry and to die on the cross, right? The Israelites will be called back out of Babylon, and then Revelation gives us the picture of the final arrival, right, in the heavenly country, and it's that final movement captured, right, where everything comes to a standstill, and it ends in worship, and I love I was looking at some of the hymns we have. For the Feast of the Holy Innocents, and the Sweet Flowerets of the Martyr Band, it beautifully captures how even these children are part of that glorious group of saints, right? And it describes them as little ones playing with the palm and the crown behind the altar of the Lord, of the Lamb, right? So you get this this imagery, not just of the myriads and myriads of adults standing there singing and praising, but of the groups of children who are running between their legs and playing with playing with the palm and the crown like their toys, and there you finally see that final movement, right, from mourning and despair to playful joy. They've suffered greatly, right? Even these infants have suffered greatly, and they might not recognize it. I guess we don't know what goes through the minds of infants. They experience pain and suffering just as much as we do, but though their innocent blood has been shed, right, they remain unstained because of the blood of the Lamb, which has washed them. And so they put, I love this, just that image of playing in the shadow of the Lamb for eternity. They follow, it is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And I just picture this, these toddlers chasing after the Lamb into eternity.
That is a beautiful picture, and those who had their whole life ahead of them, it would seem that our default condition is death, when in fact Revelation says no. It's never, life has always and will always be the default condition, because this is a creation, and it's a creation that has been redeemed. And like I said, what you've helped me appreciate, Ethan, is the just how empty these words sound, but that's what we're commanded to speak. And then let God's grace over time take those words and give them the depth and the truthfulness that they actually are. And makes me appreciate the whole history of church music and hymnody that has refused to be accept a false comfort and an empty comfort.
All right. Well, it's just beautiful text that we have here. I mean, tragically beautiful, of course, but in the end, it is like you said, it shows us that suffering can't be ignored, especially in this season where despair reigns and sadness and loneliness and just the malaise of the season settles in. It's not useless, right? You've got W.H. Auden who talks about the unpleasant whiff of apprehension that settles in because Ash Wednesday and Lent are down the road too. Mm-hmm. So the whole church here is pushing us forward into the resurrection light, right? Because that's February, sort of January and February settle us down into the darkness, in the darkness of Lent, to draw us back up, up and out, towards Calvary and the empty tomb. And it takes time, right? It takes time to get there, but we know that the journey is not useless.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.